this is It Cinema Squabble, episode number 13, the lucky episode. Who are we? What are we? What do we do? We are a number of Seattle's film critics, and every week, practically, we get into a theater and we discuss films and all the nuts and bolts about them, what makes them good, what makes them bad. We've been doing this for years, and now we bring it to you in podcast form. You can check us out at cinemasquabble.com. You can also find us on iTunes. My name is Adam Gerke. Joining me in studio right now, Sarah Michelle Fetters from Seattle Gay News and also MovieFreak.com. Eric Sandel, you come to us from Film Jabber.
Greetings.
And welcome. This is your first appearance here on the show with us. And Brian Zitzelman of Zitzel Film.
I'm back.
And the Examiner.
I'm back,
pretty much. You're always hanging with us.
So, except when he loses his voice.
Hey, those ones.
Loses his voice.
That's my favorite time.
Hey now.
So, that being said, lots to talk about tonight. We've got films to talk about, summer blockbusters to get into, and some in memoriams to discuss as well. So, digging right into the films for this week.
Shouldn't we learn a little bit about our newest and latest squabbler first?
Well, sure. Okay.
Who the hell are you?
Eric, give us a little bit of an idea, a little bit of a background of where you come from. Film Jabber.
Sure. Film Jabber is a website I really started way back in high school, so it's been going for a good 15, 17 years now.
Wow.
And
Holy cow.
Just grown over time and got a great fan base both here in Seattle and across the country and beyond. And my approach is just to take a very mainstream view, look at things. I try to look at things from the audience perspective as much as possible and not get too buried in the details.
Excellent. Very good. Well, welcome to be with us tonight.
Thank you.
And we'll tear into film here momentarily. Talking a little bit about the films that we've seen over the last maybe 2 weeks, let's start with this one, Inside Out. This is the latest from Pixar. If you haven't seen any of the imagery of this yet, wildly colorful, and it basically is the concept is we're looking inside the mind of a prepubescent girl.
11 years old.
Right. And her name is Riley. And so Riley's voiced by Caitlin Diaz. And inside Caitlin or Riley's mind, what we actually are exposed to are the various different personality character traits, such as
Her emotions.
Her emotions. Joy, sadness, fear, anger. And they're all voiced by folks like Amy Poehler, Phyllis Smith. Richard Kind is one of the voices we hear in there, Bill Hader, Lewis Black, Mindy Kaling, and so on and so forth. So we get a tour of this 11, 12-year-old mind, and chaos happens. We've got to get that mind squared away before, I guess, the world comes to a complete close in Riley's mind.
Well, the movie, this movie is genius. This is one of the best things Pixar has maybe ever done. I never want to go that far with Pixar because they have delivered some phenomenal classics over the past 15 years.
Hell of a track record.
Yeah, one heck of a track record. But it's their best thing since Toy Story 3. Best thing in ages.
Yeah.
Pete Docter, who did Up, the last time he made a Pixar movie, it got nominated for Best Picture. But it's about the maturation of self. It's about how we attain our own personalities. It's how the various emotions inside our heads interact and bring us into our own consciousness and how we go from being a kid to a teenager to an adult. And that sounds really complex. That sounds really like profound. It sounds like something little kids are not going to, they're going to be looking at going, what?
But they actually, they break it down into bite-sized chunks that everyone can understand. And you're right. This is real psychology. This is real actual psychological analysis that's going on here. Core memories, actual memories, memories getting dumped, and the visualization of all of these terms that doctors use, but personified on this film. You're right, Sarah. It's genius.
It's also funny.
Yes.
Yes. It is.
It sounds very heady. This isn't a Studio Ghibli kind of thing where maybe we're getting a rather dour family film. This is a pretty damn funny movie from beginning to end. It has a great voice cast, as you were talking about. Lewis Black, Amy Poehler bringing something that's kind of like her Leslie Knope character from Parks and Rec. Just very goofy, very over the top, very lively. I mean, and they have all the little segues. So we were talking about how they go into the mind. There's all this stuff about useless facts, you know, stuff that's very relatable. The things that, I learned something in grade school. I don't remember it. Why don't I remember it? They're literally dumping it away. What presidents do I need to know? Washington, Lincoln, and the fat one.
Right.
And I wouldn't know which one they're considering the fat one. Cleveland?
Taft.
Taft? Probably Taft.
He's the fat one, really.
I mean, Eric, where are you on this?
Oh, I thought it was super entertaining. I agree. Their best film since Toy Story 3. Genius, the way they integrate the emotions inside the body with what's going on externally. I thought it was great. I don't think it was as amazing as people are saying, though, in terms of the scheme of Pixar movies.
What's the detractor for you in this, then?
I thought it was very entertaining. Unlike a lot of other ones, I don't see me wanting to watch this movie over and over again from an entertainment perspective. Extremely smart film. Would totally endorse it being nominated for, you know, best animated film. I just don't see the rewatchability there, and that's a big thing for me.
I was worried about rewatchability, and that's one of the reasons that I went to it a second time, because some of us participated in some interviews during the Seattle National Film Festival with Pete Docter and Jonas Rivera when they were here, and I made a point of going to see this a second time just because I was a little worried about that. The second time around, it's bliss, because you just get caught up in the humor and the characterizations, and you see a lot of idiosyncrasies that you didn't notice before, kind of like how Ratatouille just grows on you because of all of its little quirks really does, and a lot of its little things that you didn't quite realize were there. And it was a movie that you worried the first time you watched it, you weren't going to want to watch again. And then suddenly you discovered you wanted to watch it all the time. This movie plays fantastically on repeat.
I mean, I'm looking forward to watching again. I am with Eric. I don't think it's great. I think it's quite good. I think the middle is maybe a tad baggy. There's so many clever ideas that I think there's a few of them being cut that get a little repetitive. The stuff with Bing Bong, which I know some people have really cried about, I think is a bit of a retread for Pixar, the childhood favorite that's kind of disappearing.
And I would completely disagree.
We've done this before with a cowboy and then the lady cowboy Toy Story 3.
Really the same. It's
not the same. The little doll that's being left and forgotten, and then
nothing like this before.
No.
Bing Bong is a personification.
What are you talking about?
Bing Bong is a personification of pure, unadulterated love. What he means to this film is a release of childhood and a way to emerge into your adult years. He is the only purely selfless character in the entire film. And what happens to him is genius and heartfelt in a way that just is beyond profound.
And I think one of the things that Bing Bong also helps to create, and was discussing some of the stronger points of Pixar's films, is basically their character development and just how fleshed out their characters generally are, the arcs that they all contain. That's one of the devilishly clever things that Pixar has almost always done with all of their films in their writing, is they make these really 3D characters that we can relate to and that we can actually buy into their story. Bing Bong is part of that journey and is necessary to be there in order to bring us to, if we're going to talk hero's quest, you know, after the cave scene, this is the emergence of the cave scene. And getting out back into the world, having learned the lesson. He is instrumental in that lesson learning.
I think the arcs in this are just a little too clean, a little too rushed, not as fleshed out as I'd care for.
You're wrong.
They're fine. They're well done. I just don't think they're great.
I see your point about Bing Bong, but I didn't have that same reaction. Mm-hmm. I probably skew more towards the other guys here. That being said, I do agree that the middle part, like when they're going from abstract world to imagination world to whatever, it's like, after a while, I was like, okay, get on with it. I'm ready for you to get back into headquarters and wrap things up.
Yeah, they're clever in and of themselves, but they kind of play in similar beats.
And I would not agree with that at all. I think they are necessary for this journey for Riley to become who she needs to be.
So, Sprints, you wanted to mention something here.
Producer Sprints here. Got a little bit of a tidbit for you. Talking about Pixar and developing characters, what they did with this film is usually for animation, they record characters individually in a studio with nobody else. What they did with this film is all the characters got to be in studio together and improvise together. And they actually would hear the executives in their ears and they would come and develop something together. And I thought that was just kind of interesting. And it portrayed during the film.
Fascinating. Yeah.
Brian?
They do this all the time. I mean, not every movie does this, but I mean, if it's not Eddie Murphy showing up for a check for DreamWorks and Shrek, you know, that is interesting. Pixar very much is such a creative force that's a unity. The hard thing when you say, like, Pete Docter is the man behind this, you know, or Andrew Laster, or any of those people, if you ever study seeing the extras on how Pixar makes stuff, it's movie making by committee done right. Mm-hmm. I mean, they take a long time to figure these things
well,
out.
Well, and in their credits, all you have to do is look and you see the production babies to see that there's like 50 kids that were born during the time this film is being produced.
Well, and they're also not afraid to delay a film if they don't think it's ready.
Yeah.
I mean, we have The Good Dinosaur coming out later. The reason we have two Pixar films coming out this year is because they felt The Good Dinosaur was not ready, and so they delayed it a full year to get it ready.
Do you think they also, after the last few years where their brand has taken a bit of a hit, that they've maybe sat down and were like, hey, you know, we need to really nail the next one?
I don't think so, because critically, we want to say their brand has taken a hit. They haven't made a bad movie, and they have not made a bad
Cars
movie.
2?
Cars 2
is not a bad movie. It is not a bad movie.
It's a below average. Can you say it's below average?
It's a below average Pixar film.
It's a below average.
No.
It's boring.
In the greater context, they have not made a quote bad movie. They've also won Oscars with films that we critically would not consider some of their best.
A lot of crap has won Oscars.
Exactly. Well, but I'm just saying,
shorts too.
Oh, let's not talk about the short.
But to Eric's question, I don't think what he's saying mattered to them at all. They just want to get it right in their own mind.
Yeah. Okay, so wrapping this one up, where do you sit? Sarah, theater, rent, skip?
It's the best film I've seen this year, so
okay,
theater.
Okay, so Sarah's a theater. Eric, how about you?
Theater.
Theater for you. And Brian, how about you?
I'm still going theater.
Okay, going theater. And I'm going theater with that. So it's the theater all around. Hey, hey.
Hey, hey.
Who knew?
Ho, ho.
Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. Sarah, you want to talk about this one?
Well, I think we all want to talk about this one.
Set it up for us.
So Me and Earl and the Dying Girl is the darling of the Sundance Film Festival. It's one of only six films to win both the jury prize, which is the critics prize for the best film, and the audience prize for best film in the history of that festival. It concerns Greg, who's a senior in high school, played by Thomas Mann, whose mother, Connie Britton, essentially forces him to go make friends with Rachel, who's just been diagnosed with leukemia. That is really the movie. It's they don't want to be in this friendship. They're forced to be in this friendship. They develop a friendship, and it's life. Earl comes in because Earl is Greg's best friend, really his only friend. And they make parodies of classic movies, like instead of a Clockwork Orange, they make a Sockwork Orange.
Technically, Earl is his partner or his co-worker.
Co-worker.
But it revolves around those three, and it's literally just about what it means to grow up and to deal with tough adult situations.
Yeah, the great thing I liked about Me and Earl is it's a relationship movie, but it's not a romance movie. Or it suggests romance, but it's not really about that. It's about friendship and developing that. Now, obviously, the friendship with Earl and Rachel, or me and Rachel, are
Greg.
Greg, thank you. Are goes down one path, and Greg and Earl is a completely different beast, which is entertaining in its own right. But I just thought it was a very funny movie and very heartfelt movie.
Well, I mean, Jesse Andrews, who adapted his own book, I think does a sterling job bringing, the quirky indie sensibilities of his book, but doing it in a way that is believable and authentic and made me really go through a lot of the same emotions and feelings that I had when I was in high school trying to navigate different cliques and fit in and be a part of things, but never be a part of things so much that anybody would hate me or be a part of anything so much that people would love me, basically trying to get through without having any enemies, if you will.
Yeah.
And there's so much of it that is just perfect. I mean, there's little hiccups here and there, but the movie is just, it's really wonderful.
So one of the things that I keyed in on this one too, Brian, before you get too wound up on this, that I really enjoyed about the film, character work, all that aside, cinematography.
Oh.
The way this film is shot almost as though it's done through the mind or the mind's eye of a 17, 18-year-old kid who's a film student wanting to shoot this stuff. We get these funky kind of crazy high-angle shots, low-angle shots, tracking shots, Sam Raimi-inspired-esque sort of things, which every kid who wants to make movies does in their early films, and we get that here.
Yeah.
Only it's done well.
No, it's
the
very
cinematographer I know worked with Park Chan-wook. I mean, it's not someone you would normally bring in for a movie that is this relatively low-key.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Now, Brian, you have issues with this film, though.
I have a lot of issues.
Tell us.
I mean, I'll start positively. There are definitely things in this movie that work. There's good humorous bits. I think the friendship that develops between Rachel and Greg.
Thomas Mann and Olivia Cooke.
Olivia Cooke's very good. Uh-huh. It's very pretty. It's a little too quirky, cutesy, on the nose, trying too hard, kind of all over. I think it comes from a genuine place. I know some people have kind of bagged it for promoting its being a little too self-centered. And I don't find that to be particularly accurate, but I also don't find it to be a particularly good movie in large swaths. It's not consistent. Thomas Mann, there's a big scene that's a long single shot where him and Rachel are kind of going toe-to-toe about their friendship.
Yep.
I don't think he brings it the way she does.
And I would disagree. I think they're both fantastic in that scene. And I think the scene that there's another scene between him and
between Earl.
RJ Seiler, who plays Earl, same thing where they're going toe-to-toe, and they are both wonderful in that scene as well.
The whole thing with Earl doesn't work for me. Them being friends is fine. The whole concept of them being coworkers is a load of crap. It's stupid, unearned, cutesy.
And
that makes no sense. He's been friends with this kid since five, but he can't call anyone his friend.
Well, he's non-committal.
I agree with you there, but while watching the movie, that didn't bug me at all. Like, I was like, this is funny. It's amusing.
Everything about this movie kind of bugged me the further I got away from it.
I don't agree with you because I can relate in so many ways to Greg's high school experience.
You have someone you went to school with from five who you hung out with every day who you wouldn't call your friend? Not necessarily just certain people, but period. You would not call them your friend.
I'm going to step into serious camp on this one, too.
Being a particular point on it, but there's literally a scene about it. I just call bull.
My high school experience was significantly different than what Greg's experience was. But still, I kind of prided myself on being what I would not say is I was not quite as aloof as Greg, but I was more of a chameleon where I could slip from one social group to the next, to the next, to the next. And so from that perspective, I too was able to relate to him and said,
same here.
There's a difference between chameleon and being able to literally call somebody a friend. But anyway, this is getting lost in the fight scene that happens, I think all escalates a little quickly.
I think it's very believable because I remember having some conversations like that. This movie touches a nerve. I mean, I have small problems with like Molly Shannon's mother. She gets she's a little too comical. She's a little bit too she's a little too Miss Robinson-y.
Mm-hmm.
The drug bit where Earl and Greg end up on some psychotropics.
Yeah.
That scene only exists to create an enemy for Greg, and it's not believable.
Yeah.
But the core emotions, the journey that we go on, I think the movie's priceless.
Yeah, and let's not forget Nick Offerman makes a stellar appearance here very briefly, too. Now, that being said, I know I just loaded the deck. Sarah, where do you sit? Theater, rent, skip?
Theater.
Theater for Sarah.
Definitely theater.
Eric is theater. Brian?
I'm a skip, but I'm probably not as hard a skip as I sound. If you're 15, I totally get you seeing and loving this movie, which only sounds like a backhanded backhanded against the three of you. I could see this person making a very good movie. This is not it.
Okay, and I'm theater as well, so I guess we're all going to be pointing our fingers at you.
That's fine.
And we're pointing our fingers at you to set up this next film for us as well.
Now, here is a better teenage movie.
This is the film
movie.
We're
talking Dope, which is a throwback to a certain style of the 90s, a certain type of music, a certain type of movie. It's that type of movie. They made a lot of these in the 80s and 90s where it's just teenager. He's trying to either impress a girl or hang out with some friends or get into a different social status and ends up way over his head. This one is about a geeky high school senior from the crappiest part of Inglewood, California, named Malcolm, played by Shameik Moore. Malcolm loves to quote golden age rap, even though his golden age of 90s rap is not necessarily all taking place in the 90s, but that's a whole other thing. A self-described black nerd only fits in with his fellow nerds in an effort to impress a girl. Malcolm ends up causing, what's the term they keep using? A slippery slope. He causes a slippery slope of events that ends up leading him to hanging out with strange naked women who are on drugs, having to sell drugs, having to hang out with criminals, having to do a lot of random things while he's just trying to play
Harvard.
Punk music. All while trying to get into Harvard.
Mm.
I mean,
that's not how you guys got into college?
No. Salisbury University did, I did not write what he wrote. This is just a good movie. I think we're definitely going to get into the fact that the movie has problems. The plot maybe gets a little too in its way, but the good stuff is really solid. And not to bring back me and Earl, but some of the issues I had with that movie were it embracing its passions in a way that I felt maybe we're stating it too much and less felt. This movie, you totally get the sense of like nerd and geek culture that this guy is obsessed with, from how he talks about the music to how he dresses to like how he interacts with everybody else. Just all the little details are there without having to be overstated. I mean, Eric, where are you on Dope?
I don't know. I'm probably less on the negative side of enthusiastic.
Okay.
I thought the first half was very entertaining. He's a nerdy kid that, like you said, the movie really embraces his nerdiness. It's a lot of fun. He gets into this situation with this naked woman who's just high off her ass, and it's pretty damn funny. Then it starts getting more and more serious, and I had no idea what the director was intending to do with this movie whatsoever, and I was bored by the time the movie ended. I was like, okay, finish this movie.
So,
okay,
Eric, so question for you, though, Eric. Have you ever watched Risky Business?
Yes.
Do you like Risky Business?
Yeah.
Okay, how would you compare that film to this film? Because they are very similar.
Well, you put me on the spot. It's been a long time since I've seen Risky Business. So I don't know if I could even speak to that comparison.
Okay.
That's an interesting, because there are certain classic teenager or young adult movies like Risky Business, mm-hmm. like Saturday Night Fever, that you think of as these big, energetic, almost like party movies that have these really dour centerpieces in it. And this movie definitely goes there. There's elements of, you know, not just racism between whites and blacks, but black people and themselves and all the different extra things you're going to have to do, different questions you're only going to be asked because you're a young black kid versus a white kid. And I think it addresses those pretty well. Though, again, the plot in the back half, that adds so many things for him to overcome, and sometimes it's hijinks and sometimes it's serious.
There's a lot of hoops on that slippery slope.
There are. And tonally, it doesn't always hang together.
Yeah, my issue was not really that it got serious. I just got bored after a while because it was like, it was entertaining up front, bored.
Sarah, what do you where were you coming in on this?
This is a very good movie that is more entertaining in a lot of ways than it has any right to be, because it does have significant issues. What I will say is that even with those issues, even with some of the speed bumps, even with some of the humorous bits that don't quite work and some of the Pulp Fiction and Boys in the Hood elements that clash into each other that are just weird and almost anachronistic, this movie culminates with Malcolm writing his letter to Harvard, where he pointedly talks about a lot of things going on in this country right now, which could have felt didactic, which could have felt heavy-handed, which could have felt melodramatic, and yet the movie nails it. The words that he says and how he performs it is absolutely perfect. And for that reason alone, everybody everywhere should see this film just for that 5 minutes.
Okay, so theater rent, skip, you're saying theater?
Theater.
Okay. And Eric, how about you?
I'm between rent and skip, but I'll say rent.
Okay, so one into the rental category. And Brian?
Definitely theater, and definitely worth watching to see Shameik Moore, who I think if anything is good in this world, will become a bigger star, because he is just superb.
He is great.
It's the kind of performance that should make him a star.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, then there's something seriously wrong.
Throw
I do want to also say, rapper ASAP Rocky, who is in this film, sort of got cast almost by accident. He just was there to help out, and the director hired him. I thought he was fantastic.
He was really good,
the easygoing drug dealer who ends up getting Malcolm in trouble.
Very cool. Well, so Dope, there you go. Brings us to one of the big films this week, which is Ted 2. Now, Eric, you had a chance to see that with us. What'd you think? Give us the setup on that one.
Sure. Yeah. Well, as you know, a couple of years ago, there was this movie that ended up becoming one of the biggest R-rated movies of all time, Ted, written and directed by Seth MacFarlane of Family Guy fame. He's back as the voice of Ted, the lovable or not-so-lovable teddy bear, along with his romantic pal Mark Wahlberg. And the two are off to another adventure, this time dealing with courtrooms as Ted tries to prove that he is indeed a person and not just a toy, which has ramifications for marriage, adoption, and a bunch of other things.
Yeah. Can he earn money as a employee of a grocery store?
That too.
Does he deserve civil rights?
Yes.
Which is interesting.
What
because
the hell is this movie?
Right. Now, so hold the phone for just a second, because the civil rights part, let's touch on this.
That's what it is.
This revolves around civil rights hugely, and yet we've got some themes in here, recurring themes that also delve into civil rights heavily, and you start to question really, where is this falling in? And I'm thinking specifically on gay rights. And
but that's the point. And, I mean, there a few podcasts back, I came down really hard on Get Hard. Mm-hmm. I kind of hated that movie.
Mm-hmm.
The big reason for that was, while I appreciated the fearlessness of the humor, it was satire without context. It was satire without consequence. It was satire without a point of view. What I will say with Ted 2, I did not like Ted 2. Ted 2 is not my cup of tea, but McFarlane is a far smarter satirist and far smarter comedian than everybody that made Get Hard, because all of the satire is directed somewhere. Mm-hmm. There is a point behind it. He is trying to make broader contextual and cultural statements. I personally do not feel they pay off, but I do appreciate the attempt.
Eric?
Wow, that's, yeah.
It's a comedy, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like,
talking about some comedies in a very heavy sense, which is fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that.
But comedy opens itself up to that. There's a moment in the film where Amanda Seyfried's civil defense lawyer gets up there and compares what Ted is going through to the Dred Scott case of 1857. So if you know what the Dred Scott case was, it's a very odd moment, and you have to try to wrap your head around it. It works. It's also offensive, but it also makes you think.
Is it funny? Yeah,
no. So
well,
so the civil rights thing. I skip.
On to the next one.
Well, the movie itself, I did find funny.
You just said you didn't find it funny.
No, I didn't.
I didn't find
all the courtroom stuff. Like, it gets bogged down in like courtroom speeches and all this stuff. And it's like, yeah, there's some, you know, underlying text. Ted, the franchise, wrong venue for that. At least that didn't really click with me. I just got sort of bored during some of those courtroom scenes. I'm like, make me laugh. And when it was trying to make me laugh, it worked for the most part. But, oh my gosh, I mean, I was like, why do they have all this? You chose to go courtroom on this sequel? It's just weird.
Well, I thought but it does make sense. And I actually did agree with a lot of the humor actually was kind of on point and ridiculously just absurdist Family Guy humor, which is one of the things we all made the comment when we walked out of there. This is like watching a 2-hour Family Guy episode.
Lots of penis
which
jokes.
Which is the problem.
Unless you're a fan of Family Guy.
You're going to be happy with.
Not so many fart jokes this time around.
Penis jokes.
Sure. Plenty
plentiful.
Of them. Yep. Glass bong, everything that looks like a penis, of course.
Oh, and Patrick Warburton and Michael Dorn show up at Comic-Con in costumes that brought everybody to tears and laughter.
The Comic-Con bit, I will say, is great. And Sarah and I sat through the credits watching this to see how many special credit goes to. Relatively short list considering all the characters you actually see at Comic-Con all getting involved, and I'll spoil it, getting involved in a rumble, right?
Okay.
So
is Mila Kunis in this thing?
She's not here. My issues, I have a lot of issues with the film. My issues with the film have a lot to do with my issues with Family Guy.
Okay.
It's just fractured. It's just jokes for the sake of jokes a lot of times. In the case of this movie, it takes almost a half an hour before the actual plot of the film kicks in.
Yeah.
There's maybe 20 to 30 minutes of actual plot in the movie.
Yeah. And,
and the movie runs 2 hours long.
Yeah, and a 10-minute dance sequence to kick off the movie.
But that's classic McFarlane in many
Can I
regards.
Ask one last question before we wrap up Ted 2, the attending or whatever it's called? Seattle-centric? I know Tom Brady's in this. How'd that go over with everybody? Isn't Tom Brady in this?
Tom Brady is in it.
Did he get booed at the screening?
He didn't get booed, but he doesn't get off easily either, so to speak, in this get off.
Better actor, Tom Brady in this or Russell Wilson in Entourage, the movie.
They should both stick with their day jobs.
Yes, don't quit the day job.
Well said.
Okay.
Yeah. Sarah, theater rent, skip?
I'm skipping.
Okay. Eric?
I'd say rent.
Rent. And you know what? I'll split the difference, and I'm going to say theater on that one, just because I thought it was funny enough.
Mr. Mainstream.
I know.
If you like Ted 1, you probably enjoy it.
You're in this one as well. And if you're a Family Guy fan, I think you got more material. All right. That being the case, a couple sad notes to make. The last couple weeks, we've lost a few Hollywood greats. One of them being Christopher Lee, actor Christopher Lee, known for Dracula, also known as Saruman from Lord of the Rings. Sarah, what else?
Well, I mean, you know, he was big with the Hammer horror films. He and Peter Cushing teamed up numerous times in films ranging from The Mummy to
a Frankenstein film.
The Frankenstein, and to, you know, to Horror Express. They did a lot together. But Christopher Lee was more than just that. He was a great actor that a lot of times gets underappreciated. I mean, say what you will about The Man with the Golden Gun as far as the Bond genre is concerned. The movie has some issues. Christopher Lee as the villain, not one of them. He's fantastic in that.
He seemed to be one of those guys that could take the villainous role and just sink his teeth in and just chew, and chew some more. And
but he could also show up in something like Hugo as just a delicate, gentle clockmaker and break your heart.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I forgot about that.
I do love him in Lord of the Rings.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I know that's probably the thing he's maybe best known for, at least to more modern audiences.
For sure.
But I do think he really brings it in those movies. I mean, he's playing an over-the-top villain on some level, but he brings a purity to it. He's not winking at the camera, but he's still having a good time. Yeah. Some of these people bring the right level of hamminess to these kind of fantasy big epics. Some people don't, and Christopher Lee knew how to bring
My favorite Christopher Lee performance, out of all of them, out of the Hammer horror films, which I love, out of Lord of the Rings, which I love, Gremlins 2, the new guy.
Yes! He's great.
He is fantastic as the scientist that mutates really all of these gremlins. He kills it, and he's fantastic.
Oh, that's
perfect. And he's going to be missed. But, you know.
That's a pretty well-lived
life. He had a wonderful life.
That's a pretty good
278 acting credits.
Exactly.
Oh, that's a pretty good run right there. Also, lost just the other day in a tragic plane accident. Yep. James Horner, composer James Horner, known for doing work on Titanic, known for doing work on practically Glory. That was the one we wanted to cue up the soundtrack to here. What was the other one?
Well, he did The New World with Malick. I mean, he did a bit of everything. I mean, he would do... When you think of kind of modern epic music, sweeping, maybe sweeping's a better term. He was the guy who really brought a lot of that.
I was going to say he's the young John Williams, but only young in so fact by just a few years. Just 20 years. He's like the next year or next generation of composer after Williams.
His scores tend to have a little more melancholy than I found. I mean, not that John Williams, not to have this be a thing about John Williams, but I think what really brought him, when you think of that, like Glory is not an especially good movie, but his music really lifts those emotions.
I would completely disagree with you on that.
Broderick sucks in that movie. That's a whole other thing.
Wow.
But he lifts those emotions that may not always be conveyed perfectly. Titanic is big, and that is, and I know we're all probably got tired of that song at a certain point. I mean, that really works for that movie.
Apollo 13.
Apollo 13.
I think that is one of the most amazing scores.
I agree. But, you know, one of the great things about James Horner, though, he got his start working with Roger Corman. He did movies like Battle Beyond the Stars and Up from the Depths and Humanoids from the Deep, and he never forgot where he came from. Yeah. He was more than willing to work on Chum Scrubber because the director needed him to do it. He was reportedly working on some, you know, this new filmmaker in Los Angeles was putting together this short film, and he was composing the score for this guy just to help him out.
Yeah.
And this was what James Horner did. It's magnificent. I mean, I recently posted a list on Letterboxd.
Very good list.
75 films of the scores that I love from him. And you look at how many different genres and the different budgets and the different kind of scores that he created, you know, from Wolfen to Sneakers. How could you compare those scores? They're completely different.
Right. Or American Tale. He did the music. So,
And then he goes and does Star Trek II, which many people feel has the best score of any of the Star Trek films.
Agreed.
Yeah. So James Horner, tragic loss at 61 in a plane crash of all things, single prop plane crash. That bummer kind of note, let's turn this boat around a little bit and head into summer blockbusters.
Well, and James Horner's favorite thing to do, scoring some of the best blockbusters of all time.
Mm-hmm.
We thought it would be fun to take a look at some of the blockbusters from the year 2000 to now.
Forward.
And how I'm defining a blockbuster is a movie that either makes $100 million or more or was assumed to have the potential to make $100 million or more. $100 million used to be the traditional benchmark for a blockbuster. Nowadays, you know, when we see Jurassic World out there making $1 billion in 13 days, our vision is a little skewed as to what is a blockbuster, what isn't a blockbuster. But that was always the traditional benchmark. And so that's kind of what I used to throw together a list of sort of what I thought were the best, what I thought were the worst of the summer blockbusters released between 2000 and now. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you guys looked at it, but that was my criteria.
That's a pretty good.
So give us a start on that list.
Well, so what I picked for the best, and this is no particular order whatsoever, AI, artificial intelligence, Spider-Man 2, The Bourne Ultimatum, Batman Begins, and Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Love Azkaban.
Okay.
Big fan of that one. Adam, where are you?
I'm putting it together on there. I was thinking, and I may have the dates on this confused, but I'm still thinking I love Day After Tomorrow, which we had last year even.
Day After Tomorrow?
Yeah, that's going on my list.
That's Edge of Tomorrow. Day After Tomorrow is the really, 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 Roland Emmerich disaster film.
It's really clicked with Adam because he doesn't even remember the name.
No, that,
I know. Exactly.
Let me preface this with the fact that there's an eject button right here between my temple and my ear, and after 30 days, I push the eject button, and any film that's gone in is generally gone. But Edge of Tomorrow, Die Another Day, or basically the live, repeat, die, repeat Tom Cruise film.
The studio renamed the film essentially anyway when it came to DVD, so we can't get on your case too much.
So there you go. That's on there. Also would put AI on there. That would be one, a strong one. And Batman, the Dark Knight Rises. On there.
The third one?
Excuse me.
You're picking up
which one?
Batman Begins, Dark Knight Rises.
The Dark Knight.
One, you know.
Yeah.
Yes, the Joker.
El Joker.
The Dark Knight. There you go.
Yeah, enough beating up on me, Brian.
I forgot all about artificial intelligence. So I put my original list together, I guess all snooty and snobby like me. I didn't realize we were just doing blockbusters. So I got stuff like Oslo, August 31st.
No, you know, we said blockbusters.
I didn't see the word blockbusters. I put blockbusters on here anyways. Okay, so I'll do my favorite Pixar movie, which for period, and it's a summertime one, would be Finding Nemo.
Definitely.
So just love makes me cry every time. Magic Mike made over $100 million, so I'm going to throw that on there in
celebration. Enjoyed it that much?
Magic Mike, yeah, I think it's a great film. Super fun. I mean, Soderbergh knows how to bring that kind of like poppy sensibility with
That's in your top five of summer blockbusters over 15 years.
Yeah.
My God.
I'm going to throw in a little film called Mad Max Fury Road. I think it's well-deserved. It's just fantastic. The best blockbuster, kind of the action variety, I'd say, since Spider-Man 2, which I would also have on here, of course. And I don't know if it made enough money, but it sure should have. Moulin Rouge.
I think Moulin
Rouge.
I
love Moulin Rouge.
Moulin Rouge was...
Big, gaudy.
I think Moulin Rouge works because the studio wanted it to be a blockbuster. Mm-hmm. It never really became one, but it did get a lot of Oscar nominations, and it's sort of stood the test of time. So it fits as a film that was perceived to have the potential to be a blockbuster, but didn't become
one. Now, Eric, I know you and I sing Moulin Rouge every weekend together.
In college, right down the hallway in the dorms, there was this guy, and he would just sing, like, Come What May.
Yes!
Terrible singer. Great guy.
Was it me?
Terrible singer. And we would sit outside his door as he's like squealing away with, Come on, me.
Did he do both parts? Did he do the Kidman and the McGregor parts?
I think he did everything. So he loved that.
What were your choices, Eric? What five did you go with?
So I actually did put mine in order. So counting down from five, I had Minority Report, which I think is
excellent.
Amazing.
Oh, yeah. Super good.
X-Men 2, which is one of my favorite
underrated comic book movies.
Still stands the test of time. While I love Prisoner of Azkaban, I put Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 just because I thought that was just a blast.
Also good. Right.
The Dark Knight. So, Adam, totally agree with you. Overrated. Probably my favorite. I know you think that one's
The ending sucks. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you contrarian, you. And then my favorite summer movie, The Bourne Supremacy.
You want the second one
there. Far superior than Ultimatum and even... Or
far superior.
Sorry. I was mixing it up. Far superior than Identity. Just a little bit better than Ultimatum.
That's fine. I have no problem with that. I like that for the most part. We had a few repeats, but for the most part, we all picked different films.
What about where does the Star Trek franchises fit into this for you guys?
Not on there at all.
The first Star Trek is a solid blockbuster.
Yes.
It wouldn't crack a top 25.
The second one,
one's junk.
On the list
trash.
Of, I came up with
well,
seven.
Yeah.
I came
Boring.
Up with seven for the worst part of this. I came
okay.
up with
yeah.
I came up with 75 films that I would consider being the worst blockbusters I've ever seen.
Uh-huh.
Star Trek II: Into Darkness was on that list.
It sits in that. Yeah.
But my five worst, and this actually is in order, were Battlefield Earth, Pearl Harbor, Transformers, Revenge of the Fallen, so the Michael Bay double feature. The Hangover Part 2. And G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra.
Can we add The Hangover Part 3? Yeah.
The Hangover Part 3 wasn't as bad as Part 2.
Hangover Part 3 is much worse.
Oh, no.
But then 2? No. No.
Anybody else do a worse list?
I've got my worst list. There's some tough things to pick between. Green Lantern has to be on there.
No way. No.
It sucks.
It's not good.
It's bad and worse upon rewatching.
I
just picked Transformers films, period.
Yeah.
It's just like a arcing thing. I didn't see the fourth one. Maybe the fourth one is, you know,
Malik-like
in quality, but I doubt it. X-Men Origins : Wolverine.
Yeah, that's pretty
crap,
bad.
Crap. With worse CG than the previous movies.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
The claws? Oh, my gosh.
And then the last couple, man, what do I pick? I'm going to throw on Sex and the City 2, which is everything. I don't know if I'm surrounded by people who can tolerate or like Sex and the City. The series has quality moments. Sex and the City 2 is everything that people who don't like about it wrapped in two very crappy, annoying, racist hours.
2.5.
I'm pretty sure Al-Qaeda uses that film
as a recruitment tool. Yeah,
and then my worst, maybe one of the worst movies I've ever seen. I hate this movie. It makes me physically angry, want to punch things. Wanted. Hate Wanted.
Wow.
I can't go.
A piece of PG-13.
I don't hate it that bad, but that it was rated one R. Of the dumbest movies ever.
Such a disgusting man. It's Kingsman-esque.
What do you got, Eric?
So some of the ones you guys listed, like X-Men Origins Wolverine and Battlefield Earth, were on my short list, but I didn't actually put those in my top five. So counting down Battleship.
I was just going to write that one down. I'm making a list of things that are just coming to mind right now.
I didn't see that till DVD, and I was like, this can't possibly be as bad as people said, and it was worse. Maleficent, which I thought was just dreadful.
Ooh.
Not good.
Catwoman with Halle Berry.
Oh, I forgot about Catwoman.
Yeah, come on.
What a piece of garbage.
Number two, one of the funniest movies I've ever seen, The Happening. And and then number one, even more racist than Sex and the City Part 2, is The Love Guru.
There you go.
I've never seen The Love Guru.
Oh, it was a heaping turd.
Adam, I assume G-Force is on yours?
Oh, it's got to be on that. Another
it
one
was on my short list.
You know, another one that makes it onto my list here that when we were dancing around Star Trek for a second came to mind? Another J.J. Abrams, Super 8.
Super 8 is not good.
Worst? Super 8.
My thing is,
I'm an anti-J.J. Abrams. I want to like him, but he can never close the deal with me on any of his projects, ever. I've watched him fail far too many times to start supporting him now. I sure hope he has something good in store for us Star Wars.
List.
I was thinking Battleship is on there, too. And you're right. Now that you've reminded me about Love Guru, man.
Yeah, I like that none of us had Adam Sandler, but I decided not to do Adam Sandler because Adam Sandler could have his own little, you know, he should have his own little shrine of worst summer movies ever. And the flip side, I didn't do any Pixar movies in my top five because Pixar deserves its own little shrine for best summer movies ever.
Yeah. I'm shocked nobody put Da Vinci Code or Angels and Demons. Those things are absolute
garbage. I like those.
They're both
you
are
in,
come on.
Last episode Brian Zitzelman's going to be on.
Those aren't groundbreaking, but they're not
terrible.
Worst five.
Like parachuting priests.
So you're gonna go worse than the Flintstones in Viva Rock Vegas?
Like, I admit, I haven't seen Viva
Gone
Rock
in
Vegas.
60 Seconds.
Yeah, that's worse than Gone in 60 Seconds.
Hollow Man.
Worse than Hollow Man.
Austin Powers in Goldmember.
How about Away We Go? What a piece of garbage.
Away We Go is awesome.
So, talking about what we had this evening to discuss, Inside Out 4, see it in the theaters from the Squabblers, me and Earl and the Dying Girl, 3 theaters, 1 skipper, Ted getting 1 theater, 1 rent, and 1 skip, and Dope pulling in 2 theaters and 1 rental. That gets us with the films that we had in here. Projects that we're working on. Sarah, what have you got in your...
I've got an interview with Pete Docter and Jonas Rivera for Inside Out that's going to be going up on Friday.
Okay, and Brian, how about you?
Mid-year top 10. Time to look back. I know we're going to be talking about it on our next show, but I'm going to be doing a full written version coming up.
And Eric, how about you?
I'll probably be doing a written version based on some of the analysis we did today around
crap.
Best and worst summer movies. I've already done some of the work, so I might as well flesh that out.
I want to see your defense of Angels and Demons and the Tom Hanks haircut.
Hey, I want to give a quick shout out to everybody that's going to be attending Seattle's Gay Pride Parade this weekend.
Yeah. Yes. Wear your sunblock.
Wear your sunblock. Everybody have a good time and be safe.
Indeed. So that is it for us, Cinema Squabble, episode number 13. Thank you so much for joining us. If you get a chance, do give us those votes of thumbs up, many stars on iTunes.
Please.
We can surely appreciate
much
that.
Appreciate. Please.
And so please do vote and vote often, vote early. And again, we'll be back, I believe, next week with another episode because we're talking Magic Mike.
Yeah, XXL. And the 20th. Is that the 30th?
Terminator.
The 30th?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. And we're right, if you're doing Roman numerals. Plus, we'll also be digging into Terminator and...
Best and worst of 2015. Woo! So far.
So far. So all this and more to come.
Get the pitchforks ready.
Again, thanks much to Squawking Vulture Studios for post-production on this production. Thanks to Sarah Michelle Fetters, Eric Samdel, Brian Zitzelman. I'm Adam Gerke, and a big thank you to Sprint's Arbogast, our producer.